ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
From an Ipswich fish and chip shop to the epicentre of Australian politics.
Please explain.
Pauline Hanson is making One Nation.
This is the unlikely story of One Nation.
Well, I'm back.
Is it a passing protest vote or a permanent realignment of Australian politics?
Whether you love her or hate her, truth is stranger than fiction.
The Making of One Nation. To hear the full series, search for The Making of One Nation on ABC Listen.
Food, it's about growing and cooking and eating. It can be culturally and spiritually nourishing, but it can also be popularised, politicised, even weaponised. How? Well, today on Big Ideas, from hummus to dal, burritos to baklava and beyond, when does culinary cultural appreciation become cultural appropriation? And whose recipe is it anyway?
I'm pretty sure Gordon Ramsay doesn't have an Afghan grandmother, right, that taught him how to make biryani. Like, Gordon Ramsay, I hope his ears aren't burning. I do like him. But, you know, it's not really for him to be sharing, I don't think, biryani, right, without crediting that recipe to the origin of where he found it, right? But that's one side. And then the other side is, cool. People are starting to think about Afghan food. People are starting to think about Afghanistan beyond the narrative of violence and scarcity and arid war zones and desert, you know? So people are starting to think about this in a really positive way.
I think this idea of ownership is like quite a capitalist, individualistic idea of ownership. And when we talk about ownership, it already puts us into different corners, right? It's your recipe or it's my recipe. And I think that that just goes against the whole concept of food and the collectivism that you spoke about. Food is a way of bridging gaps, of bringing people together. It's a way that we can, instead of working out what divides us, perhaps look at what unites us.
And look, a warning, the following conversation may make you very hungry. Welcome to ABC Radio National's Home for Big Thinkers at the best live events. I'm your host, Natasha Mitchell. From the stage of the AusAsia Festival on Kaurna Country in Adelaide today, a really terrific, generous conversation about food, about culture, about politics, with Dukani Ayubi, an Afghan-Australian writer whose first book, Pawana, Recipes and Stories from an Afghan Kitchen, was named after her family's Adelaide restaurant. Her new book, She Who Tastes Knows, is described as an expansive history of her homeland through stories of food, family, belonging and migration. Alana Benjamin is a Jewish Australian of Indian and Iraqi heritage whose books include a cookbook called Indian Jewish Food, Recipes and Stories from the Backstreets of Bondi, and a memoir, My Mother's Spice Cupboard, A Journey from Baghdad to Bombay to Bondi. The host of this chat is author of The Tastes and Politics of Intercultural Food in Australia, Associate Professor Dr. Sukhmani Khurana, who is co-director of the Media Futures Hub at the University of New South Wales, where she's a media and cultural studies scholar. Let's meet them.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for being here for a session on food during lunchtime. We are deeply appreciative, and please do go down to the markets or elsewhere once this finishes. So I'm really interested, before we, you know, talk about your books and talk about the sorts of recipes we have in your books, in terms of how you introduce yourselves and the food you cook, because this panel is about whose recipe is it anyway, and given that this festival and this weekend is about how nothing is, you know, authentic in double quotes, how do you introduce your food and what you cook and how you explain that in words? Who wants to go first?
Thanks, Sukhmani. I think the way I would introduce myself in relation to the cuisine that forms a part of my life and my ancestry really is, I feel like a steward of it, actually, rather than the owner of it or the authority of it. I feel like food actually is about so much more than just what's on our plate and what we eat. It's a manifestation of our cultural histories, our foremothers, our forefathers, and certainly in that story of exile, when you become displaced, it becomes so much more poignant as a connector to memory and identity that's largely otherwise been erased. I came to Australia as a baby, so I really don't... You know, food was my most tangible tether to my Afghan ancestry. So I think, for me, the way I would see myself in relation to the food is it's actually gifted me so much. It helped me revive a sense of self so that then I could, you know, not stay stuck in this past that would be quote-unquote authentic through an outsider's gaze, but actually to carry that really dynamic sense of life, which is what ingredients and food are, which, you know, in a industrialised and commodified world, we sort of forget about that, right? But actually food is connection to landscape, to rituals, to my foremother's hands, and I feel... like it's a responsibility and a gift to uphold that, to learn more about it, to share it as widely as I can, to use it as a way to understand myself with deeper legitimacy than the stories that are being told about Afghan people and my foremothers and forefathers.
My background is that both my parents were born and grew up in Bombay, which is now Mumbai in India, and my grandparents were... Well, one grandfather was from Baghdad in Iraq. My other grandfather was born in Burma, which is now Myanmar, and my two grandmothers were born in India. So my heritage is kind of Indian and then before that, Iraqi. So the food in my cookbook and the food which is part of my identity and heritage is Iraqi food which was brought to India. And then, of course, the Iraqi food was, you know, adapted over time with Indian ingredients because... as the Iraqi Jews settled in India, they began to introduce, you know, Indian spices like cardamom and fresh ginger and garam masala into their dishes. So they kind of, you know, over time adapted. And then the second part of the food is, in my heritage, is Indian food, which is compatible with a kosher diet. And when I speak about kosher, I'm talking about the Jewish dietary laws, which prohibit mixing meat and dairy in the same meal. Because a lot of Hindus are vegetarian and, you know, their food is vegetarian, that's very compatible with a kosher diet. So Jewish people in India, including my family, began to adopt, you know, things that you would typically think of as Indian vegetarian food, food like dal, which I know is part of Dakani's family's repertoire as well, flatbreads like chapatis, bhajis, which are dry vegetable curries. They're also part of the Indian Jewish cuisine. So it's both of them, the Indian vegetarian food and then the Iraqi food. And the Iraqi food is kind of more labour intensive because it was... those dishes were created at or made at a time where women rarely worked outside the work, you know, outside the home, and they spent hours and hours in the kitchen, you know, creating these delicious dishes, which we don't really, you know, in modern days, you know, you wouldn't come home from work and make those kind of things. Like, they're, you know, stuffed onions and they're delicious. They're kind of more food that I would make, you know, for a special occasion or maybe on a rainy weekend. So that's how I would encompass my families.
Thank you. That was a very beautiful stories from both of you. And I guess that also leads me to this kind of question, which the audience might have as well, about who then owns a recipe? We seem to be going through this kind of cultural moment where for non-Anglo cuisines especially, we are putting, although sometimes for Anglo cuisines as well, when it comes to baking, we are really putting grandmother's recipes or family recipes on a pedestal. So for you and the kind of cooking you do and the kind of food writing that you do, how do you envisage or how do you kind of conceptualize who owns a recipe?
We're just very politely going to look at each other before we answer any question. But in the interest of time, I think I've never really thought about ownership of a recipe, to be honest. I think for my family and my understanding and my relationship to Afghan cuisine, it was so deeply entrenched in just our way of being. It was our daily life. We didn't make this conscious decision to, you know, collate these recipes and share them for some sort of claim to them as ours alone. You know, it really organically became this lifeline to our own identity in a society that was supposedly culturally diametric to our Afghan heritage. So food became the table of our childhood. You know, I'm one of four girls. We were all under the age of nine when my family fled Afghanistan during the Cold War era. You know, food really became our continuity, and it was my mother's way of sharing with us something beautiful about everything we'd left behind. And I don't think that was very conscious as it was happening, right? It just is this extraordinary history of Silk Road's food, thousands of years of exchange of ingredients, cross-pollination of philosophies and ideas, and, you know, we get to have that every day in our kitchen, and more, just organically that became a part of what we shared more widely in our community. The restaurant started because we knew our mum, you know, mum cooked delicious food and maybe other people would like to try it, and it started with catering jobs, and then it just really organically went, well, we need a kitchen for the catering. So 15 years ago, you know, we found Parwana, and it was a quarter of the size where people would sit to eat their food. And, you know, now because of the grace and the beauty and the generosity and the invitation in those recipes that are not just our own, actually, that have, you know, changed multiple hands, unseen chains, thousands of years of hands have developed these recipes. There's this dynamism, this history in these recipes of when different cultures and identities meet. And that's very much the story of Afghanistan at the centre of the ancient Silk Roads. So I think, you know, that's like the long view. The big picture view is actually the entire weight of human history goes into the ingredients and the recipes that form on our plates. And, you know, Asia, that region is such a rich and fertile region for so many of the ingredients that, you know, are now just global, right? Like wheat, legumes, fruits, nuts, vegetables, all sorts of things that are on our plates here. So when we put together the recipe book, I was very conscious that these were recipes that were passed down to us through my mother. But my mother was also carrying them because of, you know, her foremothers and actually her forefathers too. Her father loved to cook. You know, the fig jam recipe in there is her father's recipe. So really, I think it's a very developed, industrialized, commodified, modern world concept to think about recipes as completely owned by any one person. I think that actually if we want to honour the beauty of what food is, we can look at it in a much more dispersive and collective way, which is what the history of food for the majority of its existence actually is, until, you know, post-industrial and commodification and big food chains completely changed what we even think food is, right? So I don't think it's an easy answer, actually. And, of course, there's a recipe that means so much to us because of the lived experience, a ritual, a moment, a birthday, you know, only the way grandma cooked that or grandpa cooked that. You know, so, of course, there is this very personal weight that's also attached to those recipes and ingredients. But there's also something so much bigger and so much vaster that needs to be taken outside of conquest and ownership and reinserted into this language of interconnection.
Yeah, thank you. And Alana, for you as well, it sounds like where you grew up in Bondi, it was, you know, a specific kind of Indian Jewish food which wasn't widely available, although there was, you know, obviously stores which catered to the Jewish community more broadly. But the Indian grocery store that you mentioned, which was actually not an Indian grocery store, is something that so many friends of mine in Sydney has mentioned, that they came to Sydney at a time where there was only one grocery store with ingredients like garam masala, and it was in Bondi. Which is a big part of your book as well.
Yeah, I can speak about that, but I actually have some views about ownership of recipes which echo yours. I actually don't think anyone owns a dish or a recipe. When you think about recipes, you know, I'm not a food historian, but they're a relatively modern concept. The way that, you know, the way cooking was historically handed down was, you know, a mother would teach her daughters, they would stand next to her and they would learn to cook, and the recipes were handed down orally, they weren't written down. The reason I ended up writing a cookbook was exactly because of that problem. So my grandmother learned to cook from her mother, but then my oldest aunt, she also learned to cook from her mother. My oldest aunt is now 93, so things have changed. And I didn't learn to cook from my mother, not really. My mum always cooked, but she always worked as well. And then I went to school and I went to university, and there came a time a few years ago where I thought, oh, I don't know how to cook these dishes that my family, my community cooks. And I didn't have any reason to learn to cook them, to be honest, because my mum lives very close by and she still cooks and my dad would deliver the food to us. So, like, why would I bother? So, you know, it was for that reason that I wanted to document the recipes. But I think this idea of ownership is like quite a capitalist, individualistic idea of ownership. And when we talk about ownership, it already puts us into different corners, right? It's your recipe or it's my recipe. And I think that that just goes against the whole concept of food and the collectivism that you spoke about. Food is a way of bridging gaps, of bringing people together. It's a way that we can, instead of working out what divides us, perhaps look at what unites us. So that's kind of the first thing. The second thing is, I think the idea of who owns a recipe is a very intellectual in your head concept. When I first started writing, my first writing mentor said to me, Ilana, be in your body. Like, get out of your head and be in your body. And I was like, what is she talking about? I don't even understand what that means. I do now. But when you think about food, it's a very embodied thing to eat. You're using all your senses. It's about taste and smell and touch and sight, and definitely when you're cooking, sound as well, eating maybe not so much. You're very much in the moment. But when you talk about this, like, who owns a recipe, like, you're completely in your head. And then the other thing is, like, so what? Let's say Dakhani, like, the dal is an Afghan dish, for example, and I say, no, it's an Indian dish. And, okay, let's say in the end we decide it was originally an Afghan dish. So what? Like, how does that help us? I'm not really sure.
It's the politics of food today on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas with food writers Ilana Benjamin, Dukhani Ayubi, and the host is Dr. Sukumani Khurana. They're joining you on stage from the Oz Asia Festival in Adelaide. And g'day, I'm Natasha Mitchell with you. And with this session, asking, whose recipe is it anyway?
We do have to be mindful in this day and age sometimes, especially, you know, the two of you who've done, because you've done food writing, and in some cases like yours, Dukhani, you've also, your family's also got a restaurant. So how do you honour that in writing and generally in life? How do you honour that cultural inheritance, that sense of custodianship without, you know, kind of submitting to what could be a colonial gaze, which could exoticize it? I mean, there is no perfect solution, but how do you avoid that kind of exoticization or that colonial gaze, which happens with most cuisines that are not, you know, kind of Anglo, not accepted to begin with? There's also the shift over time, like we've seen in Australia, where Italian food was greasy once upon a time, and now it's everyday food, you know? So there's both of those kind of parallel movements that happen, that what was once exotic isn't, but at the same time you don't want to kind of play into it while something is trending.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I'll just try to answer that through a story. So nobody had really heard about Afghan food in our community, right? From when we first arrived to Australia, which was, my family's been here for nearly 40 years and I was born there, so that realization's dawning too. But I think you have to not submit to the same concepts of like this fearfulness and this insecurity and this protectiveness that really is generated from settler colonial and industrial histories, right? Because it very much is about ownership and profiting. But I don't come from a history of that. Okay, I understand that I now find myself in it, and Sukumani, to your point, so how do you exist within the reality of, you know, that sort of being all around us and, you know, commodifying things and things trending and becoming very popular and appropriated really by people who have no kind of relationship or lived experience to that food and very often bastardized, right? Like, we know Taco Bell isn't real Mexican, right? So something similar happened with Afghan food, and I just kind of went, huh, this is kind of interesting. So I was on Masterclass. I have a Masterclass subscription, which is, you know, they've got people like Noam Chomsky or people that are at the top of their game doing like really sort of succinct messages, videos around their art form or something they can share. And it's global and it's quite popular. And I was scrolling through and it was Gordon Ramsay's. And at the bottom, he had a recipe for Bolani, which is Afghan stuffed flatbreads. And I went, huh, you know, like on the one hand, it's really nice that globally people are starting to talk about Afghan cuisine, and a goal for us as a family and definitely through my writing has always been for me, you know, let's socialise and make people familiar with something about Afghanistan that is not just patriarchy, extremism, war, the masculine gaze and violence, right? Let's start talking about the beauty, the relationships, the abundance, the fertility that come through really naturally in the food and in the ingredients. I want people to know that about Afghanistan. I want people to make Afghan food at home, and so does mum and like my whole family. Right, which is why we put this book out in the world. And we had to make a decision. I remember people saying, oh, let me finish the Gordon Ramsay story first. So then I thought to myself, you know, I'm pretty sure Gordon Ramsay doesn't have an Afghan grandmother, right, that taught him how to make biryani. So it does speak to that tension, right, about, you know, when is it just appropriation and exploitation of something that has become popularised and then can be used to the benefit of that individual with no lived experience or history or connection to that food. And that definitely exists, right? And it's kind of like the risk you run when you do share your food within a global world that is so set on popularising what can get people attention, being part of a trend, being seen to be at the leading edge of that trend, and there is real harm that comes from that. Like Gordon Ramsay, I hope his ears aren't burning, I do like him, but, you know, it's not really for him to be sharing, I don't think, biryani, right, without crediting that recipe to the origin of where he found it, right? But that's one side. And then the other side is, cool, people are starting to think about Afghan food. People are starting to think about Afghanistan beyond the narrative of violence and scarcity and arid war zones and desert, you know. So people are starting to think about this in a really positive way. And I don't necessarily need to be defined by the fact that people are appropriating it, right? Like food is so much more to me and my family. And just my final point, if we turn that gaze of the demand of authenticity that's always being projected onto marginalized communities, let's turn that gaze onto the dominant. What is authentic about Gordon Ramsay or anybody like him sharing that Afghan biryani recipe, right? Like, the same rules should apply. And everybody actually does have their own story to tell through food. And I think it's really important with food and even as a writer and as a person, right, that we're really conscious of our own lens. What is our primary lens? Of course, we're connected to everything and everyone around us. Like I'm part of a story of, you know, a refugee living on Indigenous land within a, you know, industrialised and capitalised world. Like I am a part of all of those stories, but what is my lens? What is my position within that? How do I tell the story that is truest to me while also acknowledging the web of connections we're all part of?
I think you hit the nail on the head when you said, you know, in terms of acknowledging the origins of a recipe. So if you don't want to exoticize a recipe or a dish, then it means acknowledging where it comes from, going and speaking to the people who cook that dish on a regular basis, who, you know, it's part of their culture and part of their cuisine. And then you can have both, right? You can have Afghan food being cooked and kind of recognised, and the story of Afghanis being recognised beyond the political situation. And you can also have the food not being exoticised. So for me, there's a recipe in my cookbook. It's called Chutney. It's a specifically Indian Jewish recipe. It's a tomato-based chicken curry. It's very unusual. I've never eaten it outside of my home or like anyone in my community's home. And I read recently that there's an Indian restaurant in New York, his name escapes me, and they've put this dish, Chutney, on their menu. They got the name a little bit wrong. I think they called it Chitrani, which is, I know. And all of me was like, oh, that's so exciting that it's, you know, it's being recognised, and I'm sure it's made differently to how you know, it's made in my book or how my aunties make it or how anyone in my community makes it, because that's the thing. Recipes are always, you know, they're fluid. They're made a little bit differently. I don't know whether it's been acknowledged as a Baghdadi Jewish recipe. So when I say Baghdadi Jewish, I'm talking about Iraqi Indian Jewish in this context. So I understand what you're saying in terms of, you know, you want it to be acknowledged and not exoticized. I think for me, Indian Jewish food is, you know, if we kind of put it on levels, like I think there's a much greater awareness of Afghan food now, probably, you know, a lot due to your cookbook. But Indian Jewish food is still very, like, people don't even know that there were Jewish people in India. When I tell people my family was from India and we're Jewish, they go, oh, I didn't know there were Jewish people in India. So there is that kind of, it is nice to have that recognition and to have that mirrored back at me. When I was growing up, I didn't have that reflected back at me anywhere. In the Jewish community in Sydney where I grew up, it's predominantly European. People didn't know about the food that we ate in my home or, you know, in my cousins' homes. And it feels quite lonely, actually. And the richness of it is so beautiful, and that's, you know, why I wanted to write the cookbook and to share it. So I would say, you know, if someone wanted to replicate it or, you know, put it out in the world without exoticizing it, like, come and talk to us, come and talk to people in the community who can tell you about it, and then acknowledge that you've spoken to them, and then it doesn't make it so exotic.
Thank you. That's a really good sort of, you know, that's a good template to follow, although most of the time it doesn't get followed, especially by the white male celebrities. You wanted to say something, Anthony?
Can I just quickly follow up on that? Because I had thought about it a little earlier as well. You know, you have to sort of like weigh it all up as well, right? Like to me, to us, it meant so much more to put a cookbook out there of mum's recipes, again, with, you know, this connection to our ancestry because of the context, right? Like look what's happened to Afghanistan. We've had wave after wave after wave of refugees, war and exile. What would happen if we didn't start to collate those stories through our own eyes on our own terms? We just get more and more diluted, we forget, right? We're scattered as people, we're such a huge diasporic community globally. And can I say the nicest thing that happened from that cookbook that moved me so much was when we would get emails and Instagram messages from the young diaspora community from all over the world. Right? Saying, I've always wanted to know how to cook these things, but, you know, mum will never tell me. She'll just chuck everything into a pot and say, oh, there, you know, that's how you do it, right? Which is very much like what we were speaking to earlier, right? Like, actually, these histories are quite oral and they're through lived experience and practice. So it's kind of like we find ourselves in these times. For the last 40, 50 years, Afghanistan has just been disrupted and scattered. We're losing our tethers to our old people, to our connect, to our histories, to our stories. It's more important to collate and tell those stories without fear of how they'll be used and to trust that there's something deeper and more ancient that, you know, I define myself by rather than if someone's going to appropriate a recipe. They really had, you know, people would say, aren't you scared that people are going to cook the banjan biryani, like the eggplant at home? They'll know how to cook it. You know, and it's like, no, we're not scared. Great. Cook it at home. Enjoy it. Find something you love about Afghan cuisine or about Afghanistan, you know, and share it with your family and your friends. And they still come to the restaurant and say, mine never turns out like this. So, you know, there's just, when you weigh it all up, the weight of sharing is just so much more generative and so much more abundant and in line with who we are as people. Like being Afghan is being hospitable, inviting people around, being so generous. When I last went to Afghanistan, people had nothing, right? They would still invite you in and give you everything that they had. I'd rather be that than defined by fear.
Yeah, and I think just, you know, building on that, food is a connector. That's Afghan or otherwise. It's about, that's what I said earlier, it's about bringing people together and finding commonalities and just like joy of being together in a world where I think we're just increasingly dislocated and isolated and we've got AI and, you know, there's less face-to-face contact. And food is also a way of connecting us to, you know, the countries that our parents and grandparents came from. I mean, I wasn't born in India. I was born here in Australia. So I'm, you know, first generation Australian. But that connection is really, really powerful. And it's a connection that we pass on through food to the generations ahead of us. our children and grandchildren.
Yeah, and I think defining it on your own terms is very important, especially for communities that haven't, whose cuisines, whose cultures, whose histories haven't been documented on their own terms, as you, as both of you have said, or been documented at all in the case of the Indian Jewish community. Yeah, I'm remembering this comment. I was asked a few years ago by someone writing an ABC story, ABC News story, about a new restaurant in regional Australia called Brown Boys. And someone in the local community complained that it was appropriating or it was racist, despite the restaurant owners being, you know, first generation Indian Australian, I think it was, and them saying that they had decided to call it Brown Boy. So I think there is, it is important to acknowledge that appropriation is a problem, but also be, pay attention to when people are actually doing it on their own terms. So sometimes it might be a satirical way of expressing how they have been appropriated. So it could be just meta commentary. But I think, yeah, listening to what people want, especially underrepresented, misrepresented, or not represented at all communities, to listen to how they want to express their cuisine, their culture, and so on. And
yeah, can I just say, I think food is a story, and that's a way of taking back our own stories.
Yeah, yeah, so absolutely.
Reclaiming culture, identity, and belonging through food. Hi, Natasha Mitchell with you, loving this conversation today here on Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and ABC Listen, and of course wherever you get your podcasts. From Adelaide's Oz Asia Festival with Afghan Australian writer and owner of Adelaide's Pawana restaurant, Tukani Ayubi, Jewish Australian writer Alana Benjamin, and host, University of New South Wales media and cultural studies scholar, Dr. Sukmani Khurana. Now, what about when what we cook, what we eat, what's on the menu becomes an act of activism and resistance?
We've talked a lot today about food being a connector, food as a form of nourishment, food as a cultural inheritance. But do you also think food can be a form of resistance? And I don't mean in resistance in the sense of, you know, going out to the street and protesting. But are there other ways? Do you feel like your story is the Rukhani because of what the way Afghanistan has been portrayed in the mainstream media? Is that a form of resistance? And, you know, for you as well, Alana?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely it is, but it's a beautiful and delicious form of resistance, you know, and it's an invitation into that resistance, because we all need to resist what mainstream media and stories are doing to all of us, right? We need that diversity of expression. We need people out there telling their own stories in their own voice, with their own, through their own eyes, with their own hands, around their own tables. Like, we actually all need that. And society has been so bleached of that, and it's sort of created so many problems in so many facets of our lives because we don't have that really organic and deep-rooted diversity in our societies anymore. And, you know, we all want it, which is why everybody is looking for the quote-unquote authentic, right? Because we, on some visceral and even deeper level, we all understand that we're sort of becoming more and more embroiled in superficialities, and there's a distancing that's happening from, you know, us being able to even understand ourselves in a lot of spheres in life, education, politics, going out to eat, you know, this hunger actually for that expression and that genuine expression in society. So, you know, it didn't start out as like, oh, I'm going to do this to resist, right? It just started out as, this is our story. Like, why wouldn't you share it? Why wouldn't you share it in a way that, you know, gets other people on board? And also, like, on a more historical and deeper level, it's always been resistance too, right? Because it's the first thing to be attacked in war zones. And we don't really think about that, but control of food supply and diminishing food sovereignty is a major weapon of control in war zones. And we've seen that happen in Palestine. It's happened in Afghanistan time and time again. When the Soviets were in Afghanistan, the first thing they did was disrupt farming. Now, we're a society, a country that was 80, 90% agricultural. Everybody was subsistence farming. You know, people had their own backyard sort of gardens. Fields were communal. The way we, the waterways, the water laws, everything was communal. If you disrupt that, then you've totally disrupted society, right? Because there's no way to sustain yourself. There's no way to feed yourself. You become dependent. And, you know, that was the seeds of Afghanistan's demise, right? When our food systems broke down, then we were dependent. Afghanistan's such a fertile country. And when I was there last year, you know, you see all these food trucks clambering through. And it's such a big paradox, right? That that should be happening to people. We have everything we need around us. The land is fertile, believe it or not. You know, but we haven't been allowed to sustain ourselves, to nourish ourselves. We've had to hold our hand out and ask for aid and become dependent on global food systems and global aid chains. So food is definitely resistance, because if you can make your own food, you can make your own decisions. So in so many ways, absolutely, food is resistance. And for me here, growing up with no concept of Afghanistan other than what was, you know, becoming more and more violent and terrible after 9/11, when I was just a teenager, right? Like, all of those things were filtering into my psyche. And so for me, food was a resistance, because it was like, hang on a minute, I'm so much more than what is being said about us, than the worthlessness that is being normalized about us. And I learned that around my table first.
When I think about food as resistance, the first thing that comes to mind is a hunger strike. But I also think food can be activism, not on as an overt level as what Jack and I were speaking about. But when I think about my story and kind of growing up feeling that in my Jewish community, my heritage, culture, food was basically, and history was basically invisible, writing a cookbook which collected the recipes and putting them out in the public domain was kind of, it was a very subtle form of activism to say, here I am, not just me, but like, here is the Indian Jewish community, the Baghdadi Jewish community, and we are part of the broader Jewish community, and there's so much more diversity in the Jewish community than people, most people are aware of, that we're not all European and we don't all eat what people consider to be traditional Jewish food, which you might see on like American TV, like matzo ball soup or, you know, chicken soup, and I can't even think of what else, that we have all different kinds of foods. We come from all different kinds of countries. In my case, it's India and Iraq, but Jewish people also from, you know, Iran and Egypt and Syria and Morocco, and that we all have a story. So I think there's, you know, food can be activist in that way. And it's not really resistance, because I kind of think resistance is quite strong. It's just more of a subtle way of telling a story and being part of, you know, a wider story of the world, you know, of community.
Yeah, I do think that, you know, documenting recipes, for instance, can be a quiet act of resistance for recipes that are never written down, or recipes that will be lost forever from particular cultures. But also something that I've noticed, especially pre-COVID, is there was a lot of acts of resistance to do with, you know, having refugee food solidarity movements in parts of Melbourne, or having food pantries in a school. So there was all of this happening, which was at an everyday level, and they might not be seen as activism or resistance, but there was part of people's efforts, this is advocates, as working with the communities. And during COVID as well, what I noticed really was that where there was a lot of food insecurity, the organizations that were doing well to address that food insecurity were not the ones doing handouts. It was the ones that were providing food dignity. Like, there was an organization in Sydney called the Addison Road ARCO, the Addison Road Center in Marrickville, which also has a food pantry. So people could go in and choose the food they want. And I think that dignity approach is really important when you're thinking about, you know, what is resistance, or what is, how do we address problems, like current, ongoing, pressing problems to do with food. And, you know, that's something that I just wanted to highlight as well about the resistance aspect. So I guess I'm also interested, because there's just such beautiful pictures and recipes in your book. And I just want to invoke that a little bit. And I know it's going to make everyone very hungry. I'm just thinking of that mountain of jalebi in your book and the khichdi in your book. I don't know why that's coming to me. Those are the two images coming to my mind right now. I don't think I'm going to get it at lunchtime, but, you know, it's just still there. And that craving will be satisfied, hopefully, when I get back home. But what are the dishes that have deep cultural and personal meaning for you? It could be the ones that are already in your book, so it could be something else. I just really want to hear about it.
Well, I love all of the recipes, to be honest. It's like trying to pick a favourite amongst your kids. We all secretly have them, don't we? But I guess, you know, one that I'll just speak to really quickly, which wasn't in the Parwana recipe book, but which I've sort of written about in my next book, is Samanak. And Samanak is a Nowruz, so a New Year tradition. So the Afghan New Year coincides with throughout that whole region, right? So people might associate it with the Iranian New Year, but it's also Afghan New Year. The Central Asian countries celebrate this New Year as well. And it's around March the 20th or March the 21st every year. And it coincides with the spring equinox in the hemisphere. So it's all about like renewal and green and, you know, after a long period of dark, the return of light and hope and joy. And so there's a lot of traditions around sort of celebrating that, the return of fertility to landscapes. That's part of these Nowruz celebrations. And it's always in my mind from when I was little been like a really happy time, because we would make this one dish, Samanak, and it is a women's only dish. And as I've gotten older and as all these things have been happening to Afghan women, it's meant actually so much more to me, this dish, because we gather around every year and just before the spring equinox, we wet wheat seeds. So it's literally just germinated wheat seeds and flour. They're the only ingredients. And we stir and stir and stir and stir for hours with women in our community. And if you're being very traditional, you do it overnight. So we're just up all night around this giant pot. And, you know, there's something very witchy about it, but it's, you know, it's very magical, right? It really is. It's like this meditative thing. And to think it's been happening for thousands of years, like pre-Islamic, probably even pre-Zoroastrian, right? It's just this ancient tradition that celebrates the fertility of that land, and it's always been a women's only tradition.
What does that mean, a women's only dish? Does it mean women only women eat it or only women prepare it? Or both?
No, we're generous enough to share it, but no, only women prepare it.
Okay,
so
thanks.
The preparation, the getting together, like it is literally like a women's only event. And by the time you're finished stirring, it turns into this deliciously sweetened, like pudding, a paste. And it just looks incredible. It glistens. It's like an ochre colour, like the earth, right? And the only ingredients in it are the wheat, the germinated shoots and the flour. And we throw walnuts in about almost just over the halfway mark, and the walnuts are like wishes, right? So you sort of set your hopes for the year, and it's a very kind of special experience that I didn't really understand how special it was other than just the fun and being able to stay up all night when we were little. And now I'm just, you know, appreciating it so much more, because for me, that's where the inklings of my Afghan womanhood started. And for me, that's where I get to retell what it is to be an Afghan woman. And it's about joy. Right? Through everything we've seen, we still gather. And women in Afghanistan do it every year to this day. We still gather. We still make something together using our hands. So there's the action of creativity. We sing, we dance, we laugh, and then we get to share something really sweet with our community. Yeah, it's definitely taken on deeper meaning for me as I'm navigating what it is to be an Afghan woman and as I'm navigating what it means to stand in solidarity with Afghan women still in Afghanistan today.
That's so beautiful.
Thanks, Elena.
For me, I can't think of one specific dish. It is like choosing your favourite child. And I don't have favourites. Favourites at different times. But the Iraqi dishes, the ones that are in my cookbook. So, for example, there's one called mahashes, which are, I think I mentioned it before, stuffed onions with meat and rice. There's another dish called, we call them in my family, cheese samosas. They were originally called cheese sambuzak, which is like more of Arabic. I've heard them now being anglicised to cheese puffs. They're the same dish. They're just a pastry filled with cheese. Those dishes are ones that still in Sydney can't be bought commercially. They're really only cooked in people's homes. Some people cook them kind of on a, you know, cook them on a larger scale so you can buy them from people's homes, but there is no sort of restaurant, cafe, anywhere that you can buy them. So they're really special to me because they're just a link to my mum, my aunties, my family, my grandmother, my kind of childhood growing up. And, you know, you touched on Easy, I don't think you called it by name, but the spice shop in Bondi on Brighton Boulevard. So I think it was, you know, when I was growing up, which is in the early 1970s, there was a spy shop on Brighton Boulevard in Bondi Beach. It was called Easy and Son officially, but everyone called it Easy Moses. And yeah, because that was, Easy was short for Ezekiel, which was his name. They just called it, you know, Easy Moses. And Jews from India actually started arriving in Australia earlier than the first wave of Indians because the White Australia policy was in force, the very racist, you know, awful White Australia policy. It did apply equally to Jews from India, but some of them were, you know, pale-skinned enough that they, you know, according to the colour wheel, they were able to migrate to Australia. And Easy Moses' father and his family, they all came together from India, and Easy's father was actually a spice trader, and he started a spice shop in Bondi. And over time, he was actually like a really great entrepreneur and businessman, and he imported spices from India. And for a long time, it was the only place that you could buy fresh spices. And so when the White Australia policy began, or when it was abolished, first it was relaxed and then abolished, the first wave of migrants from India were doctors and academics. They weren't spice traders. But as we've heard, like, food is such an important connection to heritage and to homeland and a feeling of home. So everyone flocked to Easy Moses. You know, the Indian diaspora, the Indian community was not in Bondi. They were, like, over the other side of Sydney in Blacktown, and they would travel to Bondi to buy the spices that they needed for their cooking. And then actually I found, when I was researching my cookbook, I found the story of an Indian journalist and his doctor wife who came and settled in Adelaide, I think in the early 1970s, and there were no Indian grocery shops in Adelaide at that time, and there was also no Amazon or, you know, Coles International Food Aisle. And they caught a coach from Adelaide to Sydney all the way to go to Easy Moses to buy Indian spices that they needed for their cooking. And then, you know, went to the shop, got their spices and caught the coach back, and the round trip took them 48 hours, which is just like, I know, we would never do that now. But I think part of the reason, you know, those dishes are special to me is also because they bring back memories of going to Easy Moses, a spy shop, as a child with my parents and seeing people in the community. And, you know, even being out on the street, you could smell the spices out on the pavement. You didn't even need to be out to be in the shop. So it's just a, like, I had a really beautiful, wonderful, rich childhood in that way that was very, when I say rich, I don't mean materially wealthy in any way. I mean rich with people and food and community, and I think the food in my cookbook kind of brings me back to all of that.
Oh, thank you. I think I should have asked this question first because it was so evocative, but I would have tortured the whole audience with all those images of food. There is a mic right in front. Are there any questions? Yes, thank you, Mridula, if you don't mind coming up to the mic.
Just such a beautiful, generous panel, which is the fundamental reason of what food does in terms of a community, sharing, all of that. So I'm going to sound like a very bitter auntie when I ask you this question. It goes to the point that Sukmani also made in her closing words. There's so much history embedded in food, but there's also this question of a historical memory, which we seem to be completely decimating in our times now. And I'm wondering if this kind of consumption model of multiculturalism that we have in Australia, where you go and eat all these different kinds of exotic food, multicultural foods, and we come back very satisfied with that experience that we have had, and yet it doesn't seem to me, this is the bitter aspect, it doesn't seem to me that we are in any way addressing those kinds of absolutely important historical moments and movements that have made it possible for these people to be here. So in both of your generosities, Alana and Durkhanai, I just feel, is that something that gives you a pang? And do you have these moments of frustration where you think, I wish people would know their history and not just come and eat up something and appreciate it without passing on those stories?
It's a good question. I think for me, I understand what you're speaking about as a kind of general concept. In terms of my own family's history, there's no way that you can go and eat Indian Jewish food. So it's kind of more of a theoretical question rather than an actual question for me. I think the thing is, the two of them are intertwined. Like, you can just go to a restaurant and eat someone's food and have a nice meal and kind of go home and forget about it. You can also, it can be a beginning for you maybe to inquire more or you know, a jumping off point that maybe you would become more interested in it. So if you went to Pawana, as I'm going to tonight, you might then kind of be interested in looking at the cookbook. I wonder whether it's more a reflection on the person. I don't know is the answer. I think it's a good question, but I do think that it's partly what you bring to it, as a, not you, but like what a person brings to it when they come and eat, and maybe it's more a reflection of their worldview. I don't know.
Yeah. Thanks, Mirdula. I like seeing you as bitter auntie because I do not associate that with you at all.
Relish it.
I'll answer your question in two ways. The first way is because we have our family restaurant, and I see people walk in, and I see people walk in sometimes with bristled, stiffened body language, been dragged out by their kids or friends, and they don't want to be there, right? Because they think, what on earth could Afghan food have to offer me? It's a war zone, it's desolate, violence, you know, everything that is antithetical to quote-unquote Western civilization, right? Mm-hmm. And I see how people completely change. They go from bitter auntie to sweet auntie. And, you know, actually it has a profound emotional impact on them. And so then their point of reference to Afghanistan is no longer the violence alone. And to me, that's really important. And I think that's the kind of quiet resistance that we were talking about. I can, you know, be very political about something if I wanted to. I can talk about all the suffering, and believe me, I feel it, I know it, I see my people and, you know, Afghan histories and just actually how much our histories have been erased as the foundation of that suffering. So it's really important to me to fill in those blanks. And I think it's really important to not shy away from it. So I feel as though through food, we've actually been able to raise, elevate, bring into a political context really challenging things that people otherwise wouldn't look at. And as an example, when the Taliban took over Afghanistan in 2021 again, it was like a total systemic collapse of Afghanistan, unsurprising in so many ways because just so much corruption of the government, the Western forces there, and the Taliban never actually went away. But when they kind of took it back through peace talks with the American government, right, like so much irony in the whole thing, they were re-empowered, re-emboldened, took the country back. Afghanistan collapsed, women's lives totally decimated to this day, right? And, you know, we used that moment through the power of food to really snap, bring 700 people into a room, ticketed dinner, speeches about what that moment meant in the collective history and memory of Afghanistan, and raise like nearly, it was like $280,000 in two nights that went straight to Afghanistan through grassroots communities and organisations there who used it to house, feed, shelter people who had become internally displaced because of all of the violence. And so it was like a tangible thing that meant so much. And, it did that for them for a year until they were able to return back to their homes. So I think, you know, we share a side of food that is invitation, come in, sit around our table, learn something you don't know or don't. You know, you can't force people to have an experience they're not open to. But if they're open to it, you know, there's so much richness there. It's perhaps to their own detriment if they don't want to engage in it. But, you know, we certainly extend that. And I've seen the absolute power of that as the foundation through which to change political discourses and people's lived experiences.
Please, thank you for being here and go eat.
Thank you.
What a nourishing conversation, hey? And maybe it'll come to mind as you're eating, preparing or cooking your next meal. And if you've got thoughts, we love hearing from you. Our email address, bigideas@abc.net.au. And the Radio National text line, 0418 226 576. Big thanks to Dakani Ayubi, Alana Benjamin and the host, Dr. Sukmani Khurana, and to the AusAsia Festival for that superb event. Next time on Big Ideas, it's the art of forgiveness, why it's so hard to forgive, why it's not what you think it is, and how it can be good for your health to try. Author and Play School presenter Rachel Coops joins me at the Make Good Festival, and I hope you can too. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Find and follow Big Ideas on ABC Listen to get it. Go to your phone's app store, download the ABC Listen app. It's free. Search for Big Ideas. Put a follow on the love heart. And you can also find us wherever you get your podcasts. Bye from me. I'll catch you next time.
Been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.